Welcome to the Real Estate Espresso Podcast, your morning shot of what's new in the world of real estate investing. I'm your host, Victor Menashe. This is the weekend edition where we interview notable people from the world of real estate investing. Today is no exception. We have a great guest all the way from New York, New York. Welcome to the show, David Chan.
Thank you so much, Victor. Happy to be here.
Well, great to have you here. Now, David, we're going to be talking about agricultural land in particular today, which is a topic near and dear to my heart. But before we do, maybe give a little bit of your backstory and how you got to this point in your journey.
Certainly. I grew up in New York's Hudson Valley, so I was fortunate to be around agriculture for much of my childhood. Never really thought I would be back in this industry. My lifelong interest and passion was always meteorology. Got to experience quite a few interesting storms, and for anyone in the Northeast, probably experienced a great one yesterday. So that is what I studied in college. I was an atmospheric science major at Cornell, and I started to realize, I think we know what we need to know about how our climate is changing and how storm patterns are changing. We need industries to react to that knowledge. And so rather than continuing to pursue atmospheric science or climate science as a field, I decided to make a pivot into industry. And I thought finance and investing would be an appropriate one because I think investors can change a lot about how the world works with their dollars and through the power of investing. When I started to think through what industries would be most impacted by climate and could also have an impact on climate, agriculture really rose above any other. And I say that because I find this circular relationship in agriculture that's unique, that no other industry offers, where the way our climate is changing is going to impact where we grow our food today versus where we grow it tomorrow. And how we grow our food today is going to impact how our climate continues to change. And I don't think there's any other industry that has a circular relationship with climate. So I find that fascinating. I've now spent the majority of my career working in both investing and in agriculture. I started a company called Grow Intelligence. I was among the earliest employees there, based in New York, where we worked on ag AI, so information and analytics for agricultural decision makers, governments, investors. And then after my time at Grow Intelligence, I pursued my MBA at Harvard and used that experience and time to pivot more towards actual investments. And so I interned with Prudential on their farmland investment team. I also had an opportunity to work in private equity focused in agribusiness at a group called AmeriCapital. And after that point, I had been introduced to Farm Together and the founder, Artem Milenchuk. I actually approached Artem wanting to invest in what would be Farm Together's first deal. And our conversation went much further than that. And I ended up joining as a member of the founding team. And so I've been with Farm Together now for the past 4 years. And we are actively making farmland investment more accessible to retail investors.
Fascinating. That's a very interesting journey. Now, one of the things that I'm present to, of course, when you look at the value of land, investors invest in particular asset classes for a variety of reasons, some of them financial, some of them social, some of them more altruistic, or a combination of all of the above. Farmland, rightly or wrongly, seems to have a bit of a reputation of being largely stagnant from a value perspective, but my sense is that's changing.
I would strongly disagree with that. I think farmland has posted really strong and resilient returns for a very long period. And so when we think about how do we judge this asset class and what is a fair baseline, we typically look at an index called the NCREIF index, which many real estate investors use as well. There's a NCREIF index for general real estate and for subsectors. There's also a NCREIF index for farmland investing. And so we look at that index, and that's sort of how we judge institutional level management of farmland assets. And if we look at the longest period that we're able to see today, which is from 1992 to 2022, so a 30-year span, over a 30-year span, farmland had an average annual return of 10.7%, where other alternatives, even real estate, an attractive alternative, posted 8.39%. And so I do think that institutionally managed farmland has performed very strongly over a very long period of time. And what's most interesting to us is that resiliency factor. This is an asset class that we have seen go through a period of very high inflation, even stagflation in the 80s. We've experienced multiple cycles and geopolitical cycles and issues from the dot-com crash to 9/11 in the United States, the great financial crisis, various trade issues and embargoes. Couldn't even name a period because they seem to come up every couple of years. And of course, most recently, COVID. And through each of those periods, farmland has remained resilient and has posted strong returns, which are comprised of both appreciation and income.
Any conversation about farmland involves multiple resources, obviously, sunlight, soil quality, and most importantly, irrigation. How do you perform your due diligence, in particular as it relates to water sustainability? It's become a growing issue in different parts of the country when you look at site selection or even submarket selection for investment purposes.
Victor, if I could explain our water diligence process and the amount of time it takes someone to enjoy an espresso, that would be an amazing feat, but I will try my best. So we have water as an underwriting factor, probably at the top of our list. The majority of our portfolio is in what we call specialty or permanent cropland. So those are crops that are grown on long-lived assets like trees or vines. And these are typically biological assets that are very dependent on water. And typically, these are grown in parts of the United States where water availability can be variable. And that can, I think everyone always thinks about drought because California and a lot of the West has been in a drought. But that could also mean flooding. And flooding is equally a risk to farmland management as drought. And so we evaluate water from both a drought and a flood risk perspective extensively. We are very active in California. We continue to see interesting opportunities in California, but it is not lost on us that water underwriting, particularly in that part of the country, needs to be very thorough and sophisticated. And so for us, it starts with the law, and that would be SGMA, or the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act in California, and looking at how various sub-districts and sub-bases are proposing their groundwater management and surface water management activity. Each of these districts is governed by a GSA, or Groundwater Sustainability Act, and they are able to share how they are going to regulate their own sub-basin or district publicly through that GSA. And so for us, it starts with reviewing GSAs and understanding where a property is located, how are water rights and riparian laws governed in that particular location. Beyond that, we look at the area again, the hydrology of where a property is located. Is it above an aquifer that is positively recharging, or is the aquifer in depletion? Has the property historically been able to withdraw as much groundwater that is needed? What commodities are grown on that property? What are the number of acre feet needed for that commodity per year in terms of water consumption? Can all of that be met with surface and groundwater? So those are lots of the variables that we consider when we're evaluating properties. And I would also say that water, although we would characterize it as a risk, is also an opportunity for many properties. And so we come across properties where we are very bullish on that property's positioning for water security, be it they're in a very resilient area for flooding in a commodity market that typically suffers from flooding, or they have very strong water rights in an area that typically may be challenged to access as much water as needed. And those could be fundamental reasons and part of an investment thesis to move forward in acquiring such a property.
Now, I'm not an expert in this particular area, but as I understand it, much of the United States, in particular the East, is governed by riparian water rights, which date back to British common law. And parts of the West, places like Nevada, many other states in the West, follow the doctrine of prior appropriations, which is different. To what an extent is that a factor in your due diligence, the ownership of the water and the rights to access that water?
Again, it's top of the list. It's incredibly important for us. I think it is that's a fair characterization, but between states, California is its own entity and understanding SGMA, which is California's riparian rights law, which was recently ratified and put into force, I believe, in 2020. That could be, I think that is a career field for certain riparian rights attorneys. So you could specialize just in California's water right laws. And then Oregon is going to follow. Some would argue it's not similar, but, you know, at least similar in the sense of water being a title right versus, as you referenced, in the East, where it's a little bit of a different doctrine. So the Western states do have that, you know, that almost mineral rights philosophical view on water. But then you need to dive a bit deeper and look into the actual state regulations and statutes on how water is being appropriated today, whether a grandfathering of ownership has stood in court or whether new statutes are being enforced, and understanding, you know, exactly what the risk and availability of water is on any given site. So it's hyper specific, even within a state. It comes down, again, in California, there's over 300 different districts, over 300 different sustainability plans. So you can think of that as almost 300 different mini regulations on how water is appropriated. So it can become very, very complicated very quickly.
Fascinating. So there's two aspects to this. Of course, there's the hyperlocal, when water is top of the list of that. Then there is the overall global supply demand picture. We know that there are issues with food sustainability right now, that right now we are challenged to support the population of this planet with the amount of agriculture that's in place, especially with the 29 million acres that have been moved from food production to producing ethanol for the oil industry. There's a lot of things that are affecting the allocation of farmland and the productivity of that farmland. Is that rising tide also just lifting all boats, so to speak, and also at the, let's say, the foundation of the investing thesis?
Those are excellent points around what some dynamics we're facing from a macro standpoint in agriculture today. And I think the one at the top of the list, at least for us as investors in U.S. farmland, is that supply side question of how many acres are we actually farming today, and how's the number of acres changing? And we have seen such a massive decrease in the number of acres of land that are farmed in the United States. It's one thing to put it into numbers, but it's another to think of it in terms of size. And so the statistic that really helped me understand the issue, and as a, you know, someone who also grew up in the New York area, hopefully you can appreciate this as well, Victor, but Massachusetts as a state, we've lost over twice the size of Massachusetts in farmland in the United States over a period of 20 years.
Wow.
From the early 2000s to not quite present day, but, you know, maybe 5 years ago or so.
So what's driving that? Is it economics or is it sustainability? What is driving that reduction?
It's a good question. I think that answer is going to change, depend on where you are. It could be economics for some. It could be development for many others. Development, I think, has been a large reason on why this has been a pattern that we've seen. And I think it ties into economics, because when a family is evaluating a decision on whether or not to transfer a farm and continue to farm with the next generation, or to look at a potential sale, and if you have a developer who is valuing the property very differently, it's difficult for families to disentangle those two concepts. So I think that has been part of it as well. We also, you know, a big factor of why we think that there is a massive opportunity in U.S. farmland in particular is the fact that we anticipate a extraordinary transfer of ownership in land over the coming decade. The average age of the U.S. farmer today is approaching 70, as hard as it is to believe that. I think the average age is 67. Farmers continue to work often well into the 70s. I'm sure there are growers who are still active in their well into their 80s, 90s. I wouldn't be surprised if someone's over 100. That is a work ethic in this asset class. As that ownership base continues to advance in age and starts to consider the next generation and future management of the farm, questions around estate planning naturally come up. And what we're seeing, and something, this is certainly not a new phenomenon, I think it's something that has been in the industry for quite a while now, but the next generation is not necessarily interested in nor ready or capable of continuing operations. And so there's a dearth of experience and interest in continuing this business. And often there's even tension amongst family members where some heirs are interested in continuing to run the family business and others want liquidity. How is that problem solved for a family? I believe in the next, I think it's decade or maybe a bit over the next decade, but in our next generation's span of time, about 500 million acres of land is expected to transfer in the United States. It's an extraordinary number. As managers and investors in farmland, we see both Farm Together and other asset managers who continue to acquire and operate farmland as part of the solution to ensuring that we continue to farm on these acres and that they are not left to fallow, they are not all redeveloped, that different outcomes end up materializing when families can't coalesce around a succession plan.
Fascinating. Well, as soon as you said there are people farming into their 70s, it's obvious the kids don't want anything to do with it. They have not come into the family business. That's clear and obvious. So that is a massive demographic shift that I don't think is on the radar for policymakers or even the investment community. Certainly not on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. That's for sure. So very interesting. David, if folks want to connect, if they want to learn more, what's the best way?
The best way is to visit our site at farmtogether.com. We have a learning center there with a wealth of information on farmland as an asset class, farmland's performance during turbulent times like the one that we're living in today. And we also have many different recorded pieces as well, where we talk through our underwriting thesis and how we evaluate factors like water. I think we have an entire webinar recording on our water underwriting process. So if anyone is interested in going much deeper there, that would be accessible on our website. And of course, if anyone is interested in connecting further with me, I am on LinkedIn. I'm happy to connect and chat further about farmland.
Fabulous. Well, David, great to catch up and love what you're doing. And for the listeners at home, definitely connect with David Chan at farmtogether.com. The link will be in the show notes. And in the meantime, have an awesome rest of your weekend. Go make some great things happen. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.